KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Challenging the Both Sides Narrative, Difference Between Fascist and Antifa Movements in the Trump Era, on Thursday, April 4th from 7 to 9 p.m. at Cider Riot in Portland. Challenging the Both Sides Narrative is a talk by Dr. Stanislav Vysotsky. This talk will provide an overview of contemporary fascist and anti-fascist movements with a focus on the key differences between them. Again, that's Challenging the Both Sides Narrative, Difference Between Fascist and Antifa Movements in the Trump Era, on Thursday, April 4th from 7 to 9 p.m. at Cider Riot, 807 Northeast Cooch Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the world premiere of Jump, co-produced by Confrontation Theater and the Milagro Theater. The play runs from March 21st through April 13th at the Milagro Theater in Portland. Jump is the story of a 20-something who is reeling from the death of her mother. She is looking for solace in a good place to vape, but what she finds is a journey of self-discovery. Again, that's Jump. Every Thursday, Friday, and Saturday from March 21st through April 13th at the Milagro Theater, 525 Southeast Stark Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This is David Barsamian of Alternative Radio, and you're listening to KBOO Portland.
The Heather McCoy Show.
Welcome to the Heather McCoy Show. Later on in the hour, I'll be talking with Kathy Mariah Carlson about her volunteer work at the border as part of an organization called Annunciation House. Then rounding out the hour, we'll have Aaron Brown join us to discuss the deadline for public comments about the proposed Rose Quarter freeway expansion, plus a grab bag of other news items. But first, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, NOAA, recently released a spring 2019 flood probability map. It shows that the majority of the eastern part of the country is at risk for some flooding, and the state of Oregon is at risk for some minor flooding from the record amounts of snowpack built up over the winter. Joining me now to discuss this is Andy Bryant. He is a hydrologist at the National Weather Service to discuss the implications of this map. Welcome to the show, Andy.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Oh, you're very welcome. First, I wanted to discuss and put some context behind the terms that NOAA uses in the maps. What criteria does NOAA use to determine the three categories of flooding from minor, moderate, and major?
Those categories are determined on a location basis. Just to use a local example that people would be familiar with here, if we took the Willamette River at Portland, we have a minor, moderate, and major flood category. And major flooding is, that's the kind of situation where we're dealing with water getting into downtown Portland. And, you know, similar to what we had for those folks who have lived in the area for many years, February of 1996 was the last really big flood event that affected most of the region, and that was a situation where there were, you know, extra reinforcements built along the seawall to keep water from getting into downtown, and there was widespread flooding in places like Oregon City and all over the Willamette Valley and throughout much of the Pacific Northwest. So major flooding is typically where you're getting water into businesses and homes and affecting a lot of roads and that kind of thing. So I'm going to go to the kind of the other extreme, minor flooding.
Yeah.
Is typically going to be maybe just property that's in the lowest areas along the river, maybe some roads that are in particularly low areas. And the impacts with minor flooding are typically pretty limited. So that's not the type of flooding that's going to garner national news coverage, that kind of thing. So then the moderate is somewhere in between that. Usually there's some impact to structures and more roads, but it's determined based on experience of what's happened in the past, and it's not just developed by the National Weather Service independently. We actually partner with local officials to develop and refine these flood categories, and they're not set in stone. They can be changed if development conditions change, that kind of thing. So we really, you know, get concerned about, especially with the major flooding, that's certainly what we've seen, like what we've seen in Nebraska over the past couple of weeks, and what we see in a lot of the Midwest right now.
I was asking that question because minor flooding does include minimal or no property damage, but I was just wondering what minimal is, because one time I was living in a place where the toilet flooded. It was only an ankle deep worth of water, but it disrupted my life, and I had the, you know, I was almost made homeless from that event. So that's kind of why I had that question.
If you get any water in a house, that's a major flood.
Okay.
So, you know, now, yeah, it would just be more limited impacts, and typically, you know, unless a home has been built in a really vulnerable location, you're typically not going to see flooding in homes in minor flood.
The map indicates that areas of which have a 50% chance to flood from March and April to 2019 from this few science classes and stat classes I took in college, we used to have something. We used to test hypothesis as a 95% confidence level. Is this lower level of confidence just that public agencies are more aware for a response?
Yeah. There's a lot of factors that affect whether or not flooding happens. And so we're just trying to highlight parts of the country where the existing conditions and what we've had so far this year with snow and rainfall and you know, soil saturation, are those conditions that are favorable for potential for flooding. Yeah, I think if we only highlighted places that we were 95% confident that it would, you know, be a much lower area, and we're trying to just make folks aware of the potential for flooding. It certainly is, you know, it's not a warning. It's not a, you know, this is imminently going to happen. It's just drawing attention to the potential now.
The alarming part of the map is almost the entirety of the eastern part of the United States is at risk for at least minor flood risk. Is this due to downstream flooding just from the major waterways of the northern Mississippi, Missouri, and Red River of the north, or is it aggregate flooding from local watersheds as well?
Yeah, it's flooding from local watersheds as well. You know, the Mississippi drains, I don't know, probably more than a third of the continental U.S., and so you're covering a lot of ground with that. And since middle of January, there's been a lot of snow across kind of the northern plains and the upper Midwest, and a lot of rain across the southern plains and the deep south, and, you know, and then a lot of that is extended even into eastern states. So it's just been a very wet. A couple of months across most of the continental U.S. And it comes at a, you know, coming at the end of the winter, then we're getting into the time of year now where we can have pretty rapid changes into much warmer weather patterns and also still have significant precipitation events. So it's just a situation where there's a pretty high potential for flooding across most of the Mississippi watershed, you know, which extends all the way from the eastern slopes of the Rockies out, you know, eastward towards the Ohio Valley and the Tennessee Valley and those kind of places. So it's a huge amount of area. Kind of the northern half of that whole area has had a lot of snowpack over the past couple months especially. So that's the reason for the concern. And there's already major flooding going on in a lot of those areas because there's already been, you know, rapid snowmelt and some areas of pretty heavy rain. So the spring flood outlook is issued every year, you know, in early March, early to mid-March. And this year, it so happened that really the ball was already rolling with significant flooding in a lot of the Midwest. So, you know, it's kind of in some ways, I guess this year we're just highlighting the continued potential for more flooding as we go through the next couple of months.
As a hydrologist, what patterns are you seeing in the flows of watersheds as the effects of global warming is making themselves more known in recent years?
You know, you can't really draw connections on a year-to-year basis. I think when you're talking about climate change, you really need to look at long-term trends.
Okay.
I think one of the things that's just been interesting over the past several years is that one of the big things that we look at with weather patterns is what's happening with the jet stream. And that's kind of really just a concept that we use to describe kind of the track of weather systems around the globe. And, you know, here for North America, you know, we have a couple of different jet streams that will typically deliver storms to different parts of the country. And the big thing that we've noticed, or I guess I'm speaking from my own experience, is that we will set up what I would call a high amplitude jet stream where there's big fluctuations where maybe it goes up into way up into Alaska or Canada and then drops way down, you know, across the Midwest down into the Southeast. And rather than just kind of tracking across Pacific Northwest and the upper Midwest. And so what happens with that high amplitude pattern is that we'll set up areas that are maybe warmer than average and drier than average for an extended period of time, while other areas maybe are much colder or wetter than average over extended periods of time. And what we've seen a lot over the past couple of months is these patterns set up where, you know, you kind of get locked into a situation for 2, 3, or 4 weeks at a time. And we've seen that in other years recently, and that can be a big factor with drought and, you know, maybe really low snowpack in our mountains, or maybe result in really cold temperatures and high snowpack. So I think that's, you know, I don't know what the connection is to long-term climate change, if there even is any, but it just seems that that's been something pretty noticeable the last several years is, even here in the Pacific Northwest, we've had less of our kind of typical storm patterns that where we'll get just cool temperatures and, you know, a storm every few days move through the region, where we'll tend to get these patterns set up for longer periods of time and are more dramatic.
One of the things that was released as well is a calculated soil moisture map, and it shows that the Pacific Northwest is drier than usual. Is that going to help somewhat mitigate the flood effects, is the fact that our soil is drier and it's going to be able to saturate more water coming down from, like, Mount Hood, for example?
Yes. And, you know, I would highlight that here in the Portland area and in the Willamette Valley, there isn't a risk of spring flooding. Really, the risk area is more east of the Cascades, across much of central and eastern Oregon. And throughout the Pacific Northwest, though, we do have low soil moisture, and that's just the result of prolonged period of, you know, below average precipitation. Prior to February, we were getting really concerned about another drought spring and summer here in the Pacific Northwest. And February pretty dramatically changed the situation because we got so much snow in the mountains and we had cooler than average temperatures. And so it really changed the picture. But coming into this winter, you know, back last summer and fall, we had been really dry, and stream flow was really low, soil moisture was low, and that continued through much of the winter, even with the snowpack that we built across much of the state and the Pacific Northwest. We still have those soil moisture conditions, and so I think what we're going to see is that as the snow melts over the next several weeks, we're going to see more of that just go into the soil and less of it turn into runoff in the rivers. So that does help somewhat to mitigate concerns about flooding.
In the eastern part of the country, where the soil moisture is almost at the 99 percentile in a lot of places, because the soil is so saturated and water can't make its way down to the aquifer, are they going to have a drinking water issue later on from this? Or,
you know, I don't know the answer to that. That's going to be real site dependent on, you know, what the connection is and the what type of geology they have and that kind of thing. So I think it's really hard to make any kind of generalizations about that. I guess I would say that if the soil is very saturated, that means that there's already a lot of water in the soil, and some of that is going to work itself into the, you know, the deep aquifers, and so that would generally actually be overall beneficial in terms of, you know, recharge to aquifers and kind of deeper soil moisture.
Will the acre feet of water flowing from the major waterways like the Mississippi, is that going to be enough where it's just going to overwhelm the flood protections currently put in place?
Well, I think we've already seen that happen
yeah.
in some places. And, you know, that's going to be a concern all the way through probably at least May, if not June. And then the problem is that, like, May, June, July is actually can be the wetter part of the year for a lot of the Midwest. So when you think about, you know, conditions for the Missouri and Ohio and Mississippi rivers, I think that's, you know, this isn't just a problem that's going to go away in the next couple of weeks. It's going to be a concern all the way through the spring and possibly into the summer. But again, there's, you know, no guarantees, because it's all going to depend on how things play out with the temperatures and precipitation. When we get, you know, big spikes in temperatures and we quickly melt off a lot of the snowpack, that can be very problematic. Or, you know, if we're maybe getting some snowmelt and then all of a sudden we add quite a bit of rain to that, also a recipe for major problems. So that's what people are going to be watching for over the next couple of months. And there's enough history to look at to know that there's a high potential for that to happen. So, you know, that's the reason for concern through the rest of the spring and really into the early part of the summer, at least.
Is there anything you would like to leave our listeners with?
Well, I guess I would say, you know, be thankful for the fact that here in the Pacific Northwest, relative to other parts of the country, we've actually had it relatively mild, and we're not dealing with a lot of the problems. You know, you even think about what's happened in California over the past couple of months with really heavy rain and landslides and debris flows, and now this, you know, major flooding that's going on in the Midwest. So it doesn't mean that we're not without our own concerns here in the Pacific Northwest, but they're much less severe than what we're seeing in other parts of the country. And, you know, one of the things I always just like to remind folks about is when we're talking about flooding, that the biggest problem that we see that people get themselves into is when they drive into flooded areas. That's, we've seen, you know, just here in the Portland area in Northwest Oregon, over the past several years, there have been several people who have died or been injured when they've driven into areas that they thought, you know, weren't that deep, and they got themselves into trouble. So we have a slogan that's kind of catchy, but I think makes the point. It says, turn around, don't drown. So, you know, for folks that maybe you're maybe going to be traveling to areas that are dealing with flood concerns, you know, around the country or face that here in the Northwest at some point in the future, just be safe.
Sounds like a good advice. My guest has been Andy Bryant. He's a hydrologist with the National Weather Service. Thanks for being on the show today.
You are welcome.
The bad water that rolls around some now throw me down that line. Bad water don't roll that down the road. Pull Charlie down that line. And I tell that water, water, don't jump through this town. Lord, that old round country, Lord, with my hands overflow. Lord, that old round country, man, is overflow.
You know, I can't stay, I'm gonna go wild, fine, boy.
I was born to the hill country, but it got me bumped. Now look at y'all now, Lila, still was rising high. Look at y'all, boy, around Lila, Timmy, still was raging high.
Boy, it's rising over there, yeah.
I'm gonna move over to Greenville. Goodbye. We all wandered out, Lord, in the road. Road moved everywhere. The water had been and little, knowing that road everywhere.
Boy, you can't never see y'all.
I would go down the road, y'all, but you tell me it's water now. Now the water, now mama, don't jump shores in town. Well, now tell me the water, don't jump shores in town.
Boy, I'm going to big work.
Well, I'm going to big work for a high mind. I am going out that water while land don't ever. Well, I'm going on a hill where water don't never blow.
Boy, Shawnee County is still a down shore.
Barlow County, one is over at Tallahatchie.
Boy, when Tallahatchie, you gotta go over there.
Lord, the water that rests on that old Jackson Road. Lord, the water that rages. Oh, the Jackson Road.
Boy, he's got my claws.
I'm going back to the hill country. Won't be one no more.
The Heather McCoy Show.
Welcome back to The Heather McCoy Show. Joining me on the line is Kathy Mariah Carlson of the AnnunciationHouse.org, a volunteer group who is providing the basic needs for ICE detainees who are released from ICE custody. Welcome to the show, Kathy.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Oh, you're welcome. It's been getting widespread coverage over the Trump administration has declared war on immigrants. What does Annunciation House do?
Well, ICE releases so many people every day, and they actually get in touch with Annunciation House because Annunciation House has been doing this work for, not exactly like it is now, but for the past 40 years, they've been helping the immigrant population. But now we're dealing with refugees, and so ICE calls Annunciation House and tells them how many people they'll be releasing, and then Annunciation House tells them which locations that they'll be filtered at. And what our organization does is we have them for about 24 hours. They come off the buses, and the little kids, especially these little kids, 3, 4, 2 years old, they come off those buses and their eyes are big and wide like saucers, and they are so scared. You can see it in their eyes, like little deer in the headlights. And they're unkempt, they're dirty, they're hungry. So they get to us, and we feed them right away, and then we get them registered, and then help them contact their families so their families can arrange transportation to wherever they are in the country, which might be, you know, it could be anywhere in the country, California, New York, wherever. They call their families, and the families arrange to get them there by plane or by bus. And then they get back to us with confirmation numbers and things like that. And then after they get all registered, then they go into a big clothing room, and they get to pick out all new clothes, new socks and underwear, shoes if they need them. They get hygiene supplies and towels, and they get to go take a shower, which many of them haven't had in a long time. And then they come back and they get their bedding for their cot with a big dormitory, and they stay there. And then, you know, we feed them, you know, 3 meals a day. Usually, a lot of them only are with us for 24 hours or even less. You know, once they get that ticket, you know, confirmed, and we help them with transportation to the airport and help them get through, you know, take them to the, get them tickets, take them to the, through security, you know, get them to their gate safely, and try to leave them a little note that they can show to people that says, I don't speak English, can you please help me find my next plane? Because a lot of them have to change planes in other locales, where here most of the population speaks Spanish, but, you know, once they get up to Boston or, you know, Philadelphia or Chicago, they might not have that. So we give them a little note they can carry. We pack them a care package to go on the plane or the bus, you know, that has food and snacks, so that they have food to eat, because most of them have no money. And so that's basically what we do. We can give them a little bit of medical care, you know, if they have a cold or fevers or things like that. Sometimes we have to transport somebody to the hospital if they're really sick.
So walk us through the process. Like, when, so the part of the immigration detainees that I'm familiar with is detainees that are in ICE custody and they're waiting a trial. So are you getting people that have just been picked up and then they're released and then they're awaiting a trial within certain parts of the United States? Or where in this long line of custody do you guys fall into?
Right. Well, most of them have been in custody for at least 3 days with ICE in some sort of detention. I've heard the stories of, it sounds horrible. You know, there's men, women, children, lots of babies. They're all put into, you know, like one room that has no windows, and lights are on all the time. The only thing in this room is a toilet that has like a half wall around it. And one man told us this story. They they kept putting more and more and more people in, and they were begging them, please don't put any more people in here. So they got so many people they couldn't even sit down or lay down. So they just kind of, like, one guy would lean up against the wall kind of in a sitting position, mm-hmm. with his back against the wall, and the next person would sit on his lap, and the next person. And they also told us that, I've heard this story more than once, all they get to eat is one frozen burrito in 24 hours. They got, well, if they were there 3 days, they got three burritos. And these burritos are not heated up frozen ones. They're still frozen when they give them to them. And a lot of the kids can't eat them. They're sick when they get to come to us. They've got stomach problems. Of course, the stress. I don't know. I forgot the rest of your question.
So basically, when they releases them, are they awaiting court dates or further legal action? Or
right.
And so when
they have their person that they're going to contact. Let's say that person's in New York. So they'll have a date set. Like, some of them are 2 weeks out. Some of them are a month out. They have a date that they're supposed to show up at that immigration court when they get to their locale. So they're here, they're asylum seekers, and they're waiting to be heard.
So the Trump administration has been notorious for trying to cut down on the number of claims of refugee status. Have you noticed that as well with your work in this group?
They're all refugees, as far as I know. I mean, I don't know if they... I know that they're still separating some families at the border. We hear those stories all the time of children being, you know, sent off to detention camps in Florida. One the other day that was 14. He got separated from his mom and his little... another sibling that was younger. And they sent the 14-year-old off. Another one was... a wife and a husband with two children were separated. One child went with the dad, and he came to us, and he didn't know where his wife and the other child went. So they're definitely separating families. You know, not, I don't think, to the extent that they were, but, yeah, it's pretty sad.
So what can KVU listeners do to help?
If you've got 2 weeks out of your life that you want to spend doing something that's really hard and really exhausting but incredibly rewarding, you could come and volunteer. The volunteers, you know, I think I kind of told you what we do. We help with the meals. We help get them clothes. We help take them to the airport. There's tons of work to do, and we definitely need more volunteers. And, you know, if somebody wants to donate financially, that would be amazing. You could send things in the mail, but it's going to cost more probably than we could get it for down here. But little things that they need. You'd be surprised how many people ask for shoelaces. We can't keep them, and deodorant. We can't keep either one of those things. Coloring books for kids. Oh, hats, warm hats, jackets, you know, because we're still sending them to really cold climates, and we don't have enough of those because people that donate locally, they don't have the kind of clothes that you need for up north. So I'm not sure how efficient it would be to send those, but we definitely have a need for that. This organization, even though it's been there for 40 years, has no permanent funding sources. They totally depend on spontaneous donations. It's amazing. I don't know how they make it happen every month, but they do. And so if your heart calls you, maybe you could help that way.
You're actually from Hood River, and you're volunteering down in El Paso, Texas. What are some of the horror stories that you're hearing from the border?
Well, the other night, one of the volunteers came in and said she'd been past the border wall, like in this one particular spot, several times that day. And there was a group of refugees on the other side of the wall. And they were at a place that's usually a gate, but it's been closed. And they wanted to, you know, turn themselves in. And the Border Patrol had passed them several times, but they were ignoring them. I guess they maybe thought they would go away or something. And so our volunteer saw them, and she was concerned because they'd been there all day and into the night, and it was getting cold, and she knew the mat probably hadn't eaten or had any water. So she says, well, let's get some sandwiches and water and take over there. And so she says, she tells me on the way out the door, she goes, well, what I was thinking was that we could stand on top of my car and pitch this stuff over this 20-foot fence. And I said, oh, okay. I said, can we get arrested for doing this? And she said, well, if we do, my community will bail us out. This lady is a nun, and she's 80 years old. We're going out. Yeah, right. So we get there to this place, and so I guess the news people had heard about this group of people. So there's like several local news stations at this place where we go. And one of the interesting things, there was this little pass-through thing in the gate. It's probably to push, you know, to push your papers through so they can see it, mm-hmm. or something. It was just a small opening. And so we didn't have to pitch the stuff over the fence or stand on the roof of her car. But anyway, we pushed the stuff through there, and we could see because the news cameras had their, you know, their lights going, you know, how they do. And so, you know, we could see silhouettes mostly. But there was quite a few people there with quite a number of kids. So we went back and got some more supplies, some more sandwiches and water and some blankets, and took it back over. I don't know if it was enough for all of them, but we heard that later on, it was either that night or the next morning, that some local unfriendlies had gone near that place with rifles pointing them at people, but there was no violence. Just, we didn't hear about any violence. It was just, you know, just the fact that they did that was kind of scary. But finally, in the morning, the Border Patrol did pick them up, and so I guess they probably started their asylum process then.
Over the holidays, there's a story on Democracy Now! Where authorities in El Paso, Texas had to scramble to find basically shelter for immigrants that were just suddenly released by ICE outside of a Greyhound bus terminal. Is that right. happening anymore?
Once in a while, we find one or two. And the group, again, and that's how I found this place to volunteer at, was I saw that article, and they mentioned Annunciation House. And that they didn't know why they hadn't called them. They've been working with ICE for years, and they usually always call them. But for some reason, on the 23rd, 24th, and 25th of December, they decided to do that. And so they had to scramble to find places to put all these people. There was like 1,000 people over these 3 days total. And so they ended up, I don't know, they got some anonymous, great, wonderful person donated a bunch of money, and they were able to rent hotel rooms for these folks. And they were, a lot of them were coming in, a lot of it was coming in on Christmas Eve. And the people that worked in the hotels, I mean, they weren't volunteers, they really didn't know anything about this, but they saw these little kids coming in on Christmas Eve. So a lot of them called their spouses and said, hey, run to Walmart and get some little cards and some coloring books and, you know, some just some little things so they would have something to give to them on Christmas. And I thought that was such a wonderful, wonderful. The people in El Paso are incredible.
In your experience volunteering on the border, have there been any positive stories?
Okay, well, I had this one thing happen the other morning that was so sweet. I took this family, just a dad and this little girl. She was 7, you know how 7-year-olds, they don't have any little teeth in the front, but she was so cute. And we went to the airport to get their tickets, and there was a bad storm somewhere else, and there was all these flights had been canceled, so there's just this big long line, and we're in it. The lady that's in front of me, she starts talking to me, and we're talking about everything, and she's got a little girl with her, and the little girl has got this unicorn that's about 3 feet high. It's a big purple unicorn with a pink horn and a crown, and she's holding this thing. And so, you know, this lady and I are talking, and at one point she asked the man, she can see that I'm with him, and she asked him where he's from, and he says Guatemala, and all I said to her about it was I said, yeah, they've been through a lot. And then we didn't have any more conversation about them, and we're still working our way towards the front of the line. And so So finally, we're almost up to the front, and the little girl that's with the woman that I'm talking to, she comes over to the little girl, and she gives her the uniform. She asks, here, do you want this? And the little girl is just, oh, my gosh, it was so sweet. I started crying. So then, just as they went to get to the, there were the next people to go up to the ticket counter, the grandma of this group says to her, she says to me, she goes, do they have any money? And I said, oh, no. I said, but we send a nice lunch with them and snacks and everything, so they have food until they get to their family. So she, you know, reaches in, grabs some money, wraps it up, hands it to the dad and says, here, you know, take this so you won't be broke on your trip. And so we're saying goodbye at the ticket counter while hugging and crying at the same time. It was such a beautiful moment. It just tells you how these people here in El Paso are so in tune with what is going on. I mean, their hearts are in tune with this, with the humanitarian part of this.
Is there anything else that you want to leave KBOO listeners with?
Gosh, let me think. I don't know. Just soften your heart and reach out.
That's something that we can all use.
The other thing that people could do is to contact their congressmen and their senators and tell them they need to address this humanitarian crisis. Yeah, two things. One is there's the Eighth Amendment, which is it says that we're not allowed to torture people. And then the other thing is that there's every state has rules about how children should be treated, and I think the way these kids are being treated is, and I'm an RN also, so I'm what they call a mandatory reporter. I believe that this is neglect and abuse of these children, and so I think that maybe we could, you know, maybe there's a possibility of going at it from that angle, you know, to get, of course, the state of Texas would have to take that up, but you know, if there's enough people out there yelling and screaming, maybe something will happen.
My guest has been Kathy Mariah Carlson. She's volunteering with Annunciation House in El Paso, Texas, and trying to aid all the ICE detainees that are released from ICE custody. Thank you for joining us on the Heather McCoy Show.
Thank you.
Everything you do, you talk with everybody, and you do it with such style. Can I go home with you, sweetheart, and stay with you a while? On my phone, I wonder how I got this way. I never seem to smile. Can I go home with you, sweetheart, and stay with you a while? No more blue nights. When we go walking hand in hand, everything's gonna be alright. I sit here hoping for the day that we walk down the aisle. Can I go home with you, sweetheart, and stay with you a while?
you beat her by a mile. Can I go home with you, sweetheart, and stay with you a while? Can I go home with you, sweetheart, and stay with you a while?
The Heather McCoy Show.
And welcome back to the Heather McCoy Show. Joining us now is Aaron Brown from No More Freeways PDX. He's here to provide us an update on ODOT's proposed Rose Quarter Freeway expansion. And the upcoming deadline for public comment is on April 1st. Welcome to the show, Aaron.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Feeling better.
I have a cold, but the concussion's kind of going away very slowly. Thanks for your well wishes. As I mentioned, the end of public comment is coming up at the end of this month. What's the next step in the process for ODOT and for No More Freeways PDX?
Well, at this point, it's all geared towards figuring out how many people we can get on the record to oppose this $500 million freeway expansion that won't solve congestion, that is bad for air pollution. It's expanding into the backyard of Harriet Tubman Middle School. It is not a traffic safety improvement, and it's also terrible for carbon emissions. 40% of Oregon's carbon emissions come from transportation. So we are trying to say that this is a bad thing that we should be not spending $500 million on. And the public comment process started on February 15th, and it finishes on April 1st. So that's next Monday. So if you have any interest in joining us in opposing this project, there will be future opportunities down the road, but I can't stress enough that spending a 5 minutes to send in a comment to ODOT between now and 5 o'clock on April 1st is super huge. To your question as to what happens next, all of the information and all of the public comments and, you know, information that government groups and nonprofit groups have sent in, ODOT has to review all of those and respond to all of them through the NEPA process, the National Environmental Protection Act process. So essentially, the next step is the government has to listen to all of our responses and decide whether or not and how they change the project based on our feedback. So we're submitting all this feedback, pointing out all of their flaws, and we'll see the extent to which they do or do not follow through with our requests.
Because this isn't a full environmental impact report. This is just kind of a environmental assessment, which is a different thing, right?
Correct. So instead of doing the full environmental impact statement, as you were suggesting, ODOT went with an environmental assessment, which is it's truncated, it's shorter, it's cheaper. ODOT was trying to sneak this project through without the public noticing. So the public noticed. And we've got numerous organizations and advisory committees and Portland Public Schools, a bunch of really big, you know, public players in a lot of these advocacy spaces all demanding that ODOT go back to the drawing board and do a full environmental impact statement because there are significant impacts that this project will have on our community.
I'm familiar. I studied at Cal Poly San Luis Obispo, so I'm more familiar with the California process. Are you worried that ODOT might actually take all of your comments into consideration and then do what's called a statement of overriding concerns? So CEQA and MEPA are basically disclosure laws saying this is what's going to happen to the environment if we proceed with Project X. Are you worried that they're going to do a statement of overriding considerations going, yeah, we know pollution is going to increase, but this is why we need to do this?
Potentially. I mean, I think that a big story that broke this week is that ODOT's traffic projections, on which all of their findings on how this project will impact the community, are based on the assumption that we do, in fact, build a $3 billion Columbia River crossing project right up the river, which A, is dead. Like, there's no, you know, there's some folks in Washington starting to talk about it, but all of the traffic problems that happen in the Rose Quarter and are projected to get worse between now and 2045, a significant amount of those problems are based on that bridge being a fire hose of more traffic, adding even more stress to the area. So that's a really disingenuous assumption that's baked into all of ODOT's modeling that we called them out on. And we're saying you need to be exploring congestion pricing, or you need to be looking at not building this bridge, just because if you are proposing this project, you need to be giving the full outlining opportunities of what the other possibilities are instead of doing this project. So to your question, yes, there's definitely an opportunity for the government, for ODOT, to respond with, oh, we listened to your concerns and we fixed them. But many of the concerns that we're listing are actually some very significant qualitative and quantitative sleights of hand that we think in a legal court of law are disingenuous and enough for us to challenge them effectively.
I talked to you last time and you guys
seem like you were preparing a lawsuit. Is that still like looking like that's on?
It'll be, I mean, it's going to be a question of how ODOT responds to all of our findings and all of our response.
Okay.
Right? So if that makes sense. Like, you know, ODOT might on their own decide, wow, Portland Public Schools, the city's bicycle advisory committee, pedestrian advisory committee, numerous advocacy groups, including many that supported the funding package that this freeway is part of, numerous environmental groups, clean air groups, so many different organizations have all put on the record saying, this report didn't go enough, we want you to do an environmental impact statement. And ODOT might be on their own, nice enough to listen and respectful enough to the community groups that are clamoring and have meaningfully weighed in on this project, and they might do an environmental impact statement on their own. And if they don't, well, we might have to take legal recourse.
And then how can people comment again?
So if you go to the website, www.nomorefreewayspdx.com, we have a spot that should be hopefully very visually prominent that says click here to comment. And we have a list of suggested talking points you can walk through and also a form that you can write it in. There's also the ODOT's email address. And if you go to that website, www.nomorefreewayspdx.com, all of the information about our campaign, why we oppose it, and how to get on the record before April 1st at 5 p.m. Is on the website.
Is there any other thing you want to mention before the deadline, which is coming up in 2 to 3 days?
I think the biggest thing to mention, again, is that this finding that came out this week about how ODOT had baked in the freeway expansion, the Columbia River crossing into the package, it's very disingenuous, and it's definitely not following the best practices of NEPA law. And so because of that, it's just adding continued, you know, this is a government agency that we've asked for an extension 2 to 3 times over the past couple months, just so we could have a meaningful 90 days to review these over 600 pages of very technical quantitative data. We've got some really smart traffic analysts looking through it and trying to poke holes and successfully finding, you know, ODOT is essentially saying, trust us. And we're saying, well, can you at least show your work, like it's a middle school math test? Can we see that you actually did the long division yourself and didn't just use a calculator? And ODOT has been very hesitant to give us any of that information. And so it's made it very difficult for us to really, you know, this is a government agency that's not acting in good faith. They're more interested in building a bunch of freeways than they are in meaningfully addressing our carbon issues, addressing traffic. And I just want to throw out there, I know many folks listening to KBOO right now are probably in their cars and thinking, who the heck is this guy complaining about freeways? We need them. We're stuck in traffic. And I hear you. Traffic sucks. Freeway expansion has never solved traffic congestion in any city in North America. And that's the entire thing, is that this project will not fix our traffic problems, and it will cost us $500 million to do so. $500 million we could be spending on buses, on light rail, on bike lanes, on sidewalks, on all sorts of investments that would actually make our community move faster and allow more people to get around more easily.
And if you haven't left a public comment, it is No More Freeways PDX is the way to do that. Aaron Brown, thanks for joining us on the show today.
Thank you very much, and I sincerely appreciate your help in helping us spread the word.
Oh, you're very welcome.
All right, take care.
Oh, you too. So in other news, last Sunday, the Oregon Ducks beat the UCI Anteaters 73-54, and then boy genius Russell Turner, who is the coach of the UC Irvine Anteaters, said this.
In the handshake line, I think you were talking closely with Lewis King. You talked to him for a little bit. Can you share maybe what you were talking to him about?
Yeah, I'll tell you. I would say a double team queen to try to see if I could irritate him. And I did. And I kept talking to my team about what we wanted to do. We were calling him Queen because I knew it might irritate him because of how important he is to their team, like a queen in chess. It was a play on his name of King, and it bothered him. He started thinking about me. He started thinking about Max.
Yeah, that's how smart Russell Turner is. He later apologized for his post-game comments, saying, quote, I recognize that my actions are inappropriate and insensitive. He added, I share UC Irvine's belief that inclusivity and diversity are paramount values. I've been around Russell Turner. I used to work in UCI Athletics as their engineer. He does not know the word paramount. Let's just say that. And then he goes on to say, and I apologize for not understanding that my actions during the game suggested otherwise. And that's the reason why I brought it up, is like, I would never usually watch men's basketball, but like, I used to actually engineer the men's UCI games. And like, I'm like, okay, I'm going to
watch this, because like I still know a couple of people still involved. And the guy is not bright, as the clip suggested. He goes to like the Quiverful Movement leader and San Diego Charger, LA Charger quarterback, Philip Rivers School of Broadcasting. Well, he'll just, if you ask the guy a question normally, he'll just keep talking until his mouth goes dry. He's that much of a boob. And so that was kind of fun. In Theocracy news, in Pennsylvania, this happened.
Representative Borowitz.
Thank you, Speaker. Let's pray. Jesus, I thank you for this privilege, Lord, of letting me pray, God, that I, Jesus, am your ambassador here today, standing here representing you, the King of Kings, the Lord of Lords, the great I am, the one who's coming back again, the one who came, died, and rose again on the third day. And I'm so privileged to stand here today. So thank you for this honor, Jesus. God, for those that came before us, like George Washington and Valley Forge and Abraham Lincoln, who sought after you in Gettysburg, Jesus, and the founding fathers in Independence Hall, Jesus, that sought after you and fasted and prayed for this nation to be founded on your principles and your words and your truths. God, forgive us. Jesus, we've lost sight of you. We've forgotten you, God, in our country. And we're asking you to forgive us, Jesus, that your promise and your word says that if my people who are called by my name will humble themselves and pray and seek your face and turn from their wicked ways.
She's about to cry.
That you'll heal our land. Jesus, you are our only hope. God, I pray for our leader, Speaker Terzai, Leader Cutler, Governor Wolf, President Trump. Lord, thank you that he stands beside Israel unequivocally, Lord. Thank you that Jesus, that we're blessed because we stand by Israel, and we ask for the peace of Jerusalem as your word says, God. We ask that we not be overcome by evil and that we overcome evil with good in this land once again. I claim all these things in the powerful, mighty name of Jesus, the one who, at the name of Jesus, every knee will bow and every tongue will confess, Jesus, that you are Lord. In Jesus' name, amen.
All of this was response to swearing in the legislative body's first Muslim member. And my former guest, Chris Stoop, actually wrote a definitive article this week before this happened, basically outlining how Islamophobia starts in Christian churches. And this even happened before 9/11. He was talking about being in Indiana in 1998 and heard this kind of thing. It can be found online, and I'll post it in the show notes. It's going to be at Foreign Policy Magazine's website. So if you do a Google search for Chris Stoop and then Foreign Policy Magazine, you'll definitely find it. Yeah, like that's a weird thing. Is this if the rapture does happen? I seriously doubt it will, because I don't believe in fairy tales, but I will not be on bended knee. I would just go, oh, that's interesting, and I'll walk away. And in other news, just very briefly, musician Scott Walker passed away last Monday at the age of 76. Next week's show, I'm going to be interviewing Stephen Kajak. He's the director of the documentary that was released on Scott Walker in 2006 called 30th Century Man, and we're going to be discussing his legacy. I know in the KBOO previews on the show, I talked about that this show would also be talking about food insecurity among fast food workers. It is basically service workers in general. I know it's a huge issue, and so I've wanted to wait on that until I can find maybe an economist to talk with us and take your phone calls. So I apologize for that. I thought this show's went in a million different directions over the last week, and this is kind of the outcome. So you're listening to The Heather McCoy Show on KBOO Radio, around the world on KBOO.FM. My engineer, for her official last week, is Clementine. I adore her. She's my favorite engineer ever. Coming up next is going to be Book Waves. So stay tuned for that. And that was and then after that at 11:30, it's going to be Words and Pictures, conversations with pioneering animators and comic artists. And I don't know who wrote this on this little sheet, but somebody wrote drugs are bad, and I don't know if that means like Mr. Mackey, like drugs are bad, okay, people who do drugs are bad. I don't know what that is, but whatever. It's the Heather McCoy Show. It's KBOO.
Thanks for listening.
KABU Community Radio is a proud sponsor of the Clinton Street Resistance Series every Monday night at the Clinton Street Theater. Monday, April 1st, Clinton Street Resistance will screen Flash Gordon, the 1980 camp superhero film where Flash tries to save Earth from attacks by Emperor Ming the Merciless of the planet Mongo. Again, that's Flash Gordon, showing Monday, April 1st at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kabu.fm, on the right side of the homepage, under Community Events.
KBOO programming is made possible by KBOO member listeners and support from Grendel's Coffee House, located at East Burnside Street and 8th Avenue in Portland, offering organic coffee, sandwiches, and more for breakfast and lunch. Grendel's Coffee House is open daily until 6 p.m. More information on the Grendel's Facebook page and by phone at 503-595-9550. That's 503-595-9550.
Welcome to Bookwaves. I'm Richard Walensky.